mention this to clarify that the Manhattan Project is concerned with transportation to the East Coast, and that the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System is essential regardless of the success or failure of the Manhattan. The pipeline system is economically viable without regard to alternative modes of transportation. To more fully develop the feasibility of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, Pipeline Technologists Incorporated, a leading pipeline engineering consulting firm with extensive experience in the subarctic environment, was engaged to make an on-the-ground reconnaissance of a proposed route and to evaluate the technological feasibility of such a pipeline. This work was undertaken in the late summer and fall of 1968, and it culminated in a favorable three-volume report, volume one of which is relevant to this proceeding and is included as exhibit one to my presentation. The companies, now including BP Pipeline Corporation, immediately proceeded to develop a project staff to continue the feasibility work and to provide a nucleus for the design staff. The most experienced personnel from each of the three companies was assigned to the project, and upon this staff's review and concurrence, the decision to construct the pipeline was announced in February 1969. From the beginning of our investigation, it has been obvious that the physical environment was and is the paramount design parameter for the pipeline. This had led to the adoption of a simple design philosophy. Design the structure to cause the least disturbance to the environment. Although simply stated, this philosophy has presented problems in its implementation. These problems we have accepted. We have developed the essential knowledge required to achieve their solution. In developing this knowledge, we have sought the advice of recognized experts in Arctic construction. Dr. Harold Payton, formerly with the University of Alaska, individually and in conjunction with his associates and Arctic engineering consultants, has provided basic Arctic knowledge from which the design criteria for Arctic pipeline construction was developed. Our Exhibit 2, prepared by Dr. Payton, outlines the basis for the design criteria. Additionally, we engaged the Arctic Environmental Engineering Laboratory of the University of Alaska to perform certain research to augment this work. Basically, the proper design of a pipeline in Arctic conditions dictates identification and location of soils that will remain stable when thawed, or where such soils cannot be found, engineering modifications that will prevent or control thermal degradation. Proceeding on this thesis, we engaged the services of Ralph Milacchio of R&M Engineering and Geological Consultants to supervise a detailed soils analysis of the proposed route and alternates to determine the best pipeline route based on soil stability with maximum burial of a pipeline. 5 survey crews with associated support facilities conducted a soil boring program over the alternate routes. Analysis and interpretation of this data by R&M led them to recommend a route along the Saginaw-Veneertoc River through a high pass in the Brooks Range and down the Dietrich River Valley along the originally projected route to Valdez. The route selected presents soils conditions that should permit burial of all but 40 to 50 miles of the pipeline without irreparable damage. Our Exhibit 3, prepared by Mr. Melaccio, provides a detailed description of the route investigation. Our Exhibit 4 is a series of aerial photographs taken at intervals along the entire route, as well as some miscellaneous photographs of a pipeline right-of-way and facilities in the Cook Inlet constructed several years ago. Concurrently with the soils work along the pipeline route, additional soil boring investigation was undertaken at the proposed terminal site near Valdez. Alaska geological consultants were retained to perform this work, with additional consulting services for seismic evaluation supplied by Dames and Moore Seismic Consultants. Included in the site work at the terminal was a comprehensive evaluation of submarine soils and marine currents. Initial surface examination of the site disclosed unsuitable soils on the eastern side of the proposed site and dictated movement of the site farther to the west, where lightly overlaid bedrock will provide a secure foundation for the large storage tanks and docks envisioned. A report on the seismic investigation undertaken by Dames and Moore between the Yukon and Valdez is submitted as our Exhibit 5. In addition to the soils investigation along the pipeline route, detailed soil studies have been initiated to determine optimum locations for the pumping station sites that will eventually encompass 12 stations.
Were to be written by the Department of the Interior. The demand for environmental stipulations or their equivalent arises from the fact that the companies now have no incentive to minimize external costs, those imposed on anyone other than themselves, by internalizing these external costs by means of a schedule of fees or fines. The companies would be given an incentive to pay attention to environmental effects and to allocate their expenditures on environmental protection appropriately to the resource values and risks involved. It seems to me that a tentative but workable set of criteria for assessing the cost of environmental damage could be drawn up by a competent team of natural scientists, engineers, appraisers, and economists, within perhaps 2 months on the basis of available information. These criteria would become a contractual codicil to a pipeline permit or to future mineral leases. The criteria and prices would be subject to revision at, say, 4-year intervals as perceived resource values change and experience accumulates. I have one final observation. It is important that a substantial corridor on either side of the pipeline somehow be withdrawn from entry under the public land laws, including the Homestead Act and the mining laws. No social purpose is served by allowing random speculation and random development along the pipeline road. The ugliness, the denial of public access to backcountry, and the costs of haphazard development stemming from these archaic laws can be seen in several parts of Alaska. Despite the state of Alaska's failure so far to supervise development on the North Slope, and despite the state's questionable performance on the Winter Hall Road, it seems to me that state selection and state management ultimately offer the only possibility of protection for these lands after the end of the temporary withdrawal for Native protests. State law and regulations require classification before disposal of land. They require prospecting permits and permit classification of any mineral for disposal by leasing rather than by location. On the whole, state land law and regulation are far better adapted than are those of the federal government to preserving even the national values in Alaska's lands. Whether the potentials of state management are actually realized depends, of course, upon establishment by the state of actual machinery for surveillance and enforcement. As yet, the state has given little ground for confidence on this level. Thank you.
Does the panel have any questions? Dr. Glasgow.
I believe you made reference to the fact that it didn't seem prudent to spend $1 million to save $50,000 resource. Most of the natural resources involved are renewable. Now, how would you arrive at a figure for a renewable resource to compare it in the case that you are citing?
Well, in the case of any resource, whether it's renewable or exhaustible, The damage would have, if this resource is as yet not a commercial resource, or is never expected to be a commercial resource, one's going to have to be pretty arbitrary about setting a price. We're going to have some notion of orders of magnitude or some ordering of the values of these resources. What I'm saying is that once you require an investment to protect that resource, you have put a price on it. I think it's going to be a lot more rational if you explicitly say what that price is and offer the companies the alternative either of making the expenditure to protect that resource or of paying to the government, paying to the people of the United States a price for the degradation of that resource. And this gives this would give the companies the flexibility in the field to use in general, the lowest cost engineering techniques. As I said, I'd like to repeat that the valuation of all of these things, and I think probably your most important resource, is no individual commercial resource, but just the fact that the area the pipeline traverses is now a very beautiful wilderness or semi-wilderness area. The existence of the pipeline does change that, particularly the existence of a high standard pipeline road, which will permit public access to that area. I think that there is a public sacrifice to the extent that construction degrades the scenery. We'll all have different views on what that's worth, but there certainly is a cost to the nation in degradation of that scenery.
In your values, do you consider them renewable, and that if we manage them properly, they'll be here forever?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand the implication of your question.
For instance,
I'm talking about a permanent resource, not a renewable one here. The commercial value of the fisheries in those rivers is probably very small. If you're talking about renewable resources like fisheries. I don't think we have any forest resource involved of any significance, or this is certainly not part of the controversy. These are renewable resources only in the extent that you have an entire complex of values which are permanent. You may be referring to the caribou. And I couldn't speak as to what the prospective damage to the caribou are. I'm not sure that there are prospective damages there.
Do you have a statement that you want to introduce, Mr. Tussing?
Yes, I have a written copy of my testimony.
And that contains the two appendixes?
Yes. I'd like to submit another appendix to the Secretary later this afternoon.
This will be a total then of three?
Well, it's all one, it's one piece, so you want two.
I just want the record to be clear.
Yes.
That Exhibit 32 then will consist of your statement and three appendices.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Tussing. We will take a 15-minute recess at this time. The next witness is Professor Charles Koningsberg, Alaska Methodist University, Anchorage, Alaska.
Charles Koningsberg, Anchorage, Alaska. I teach political science. I think it should be called political ecology, since it has always studied the relationship between certain naked organisms and their environment as expressed through the political process. I brought my family to Alaska in anticipation of a life hopefully devoid of many of the ills which presently beset American society in our other states. But this was not a running away from something, rather a coming to something for very positive reasons, especially the opportunity for my family and myself to live close to nature, that nature from which we all as a human species have sprung and for which I would argue we continue to have desperate need. And I don't think this is something you can cost out. Having anticipated that this might be a technically oriented session, allow me please to suggest possible reasons of a non-technical nature why at least a definite delay in the pipeline project would benefit all of us. I repeat, all of us. How much competence I have for saying such things, others must judge. I do know that I'm qualified as to my own conscience, and it is from that I wish to speak. We are concerned here with matters that affect Alaskans, all Americans, and people everywhere into the 1970s and far beyond. And it seems clear to me that this calls for a new order of thinking. To develop and to act on new thoughts, we need time. We, all of us, desperately need time. It is extraordinarily difficult for us human beings to change our views and our patterns of behavior. But the situation of the 1970s is a very critical one and demands that we do change. Can anyone doubt this? I shan't catalog the roster of our sins, but is there anyone here who can review the history of this 20th century and our situation as a species this moment and doubt that the time for new thinking and action is at hand? It makes one wonder. How can we talk of heaven as we disgrace the earth? It seems to me that one of the new thoughts we must acquire is a recognition that the pipeline and the overall development of the oil industry in a relatively undeveloped industrial region like Alaska involves far more than the oil and the pipeline, the anticipated revenues, and all the rest of it. And of course, it could have been any other industry. It happens to be oil. In the context of Alaska, it means a profound impact on and change in our total lives. The men of the oil industry and our public officials, I would say especially our state officials, and all of us, must recognize that industry is primarily an agent of social and political change. Its economic role, in fundamental terms, is a minor one. This has always been true, but we've refused to recognize it. Economic activity of whatever sort is but means to an end. Our lives are for living, not just for making a living. Isn't that right? Why are we so slow to recognize and to act on this? We must do so here in Alaska. It means that our public officials, the oil industry, and all of us must drastically reorient our thinking and act on the awareness, or in the awareness, in Alaska, that development in Alaska means fundamental revolution in our lives. And for this, we need time. Moreover, and of equal importance, revolution or revolutionary change in a democratic society means that the people must be consulted directly. The decision must be theirs to make. No one, no agency, has the right to revolutionize our world without our consent. The people must be consulted, they must be heard, they must be listened to. Hearings such as this are an excellent beginning, but only a beginning. The issues in Alaska must be discussed in terms of revolutionary change. The people must be helped to become aware of what is at stake. And for this, again, we need time. When you think about it, is it not remarkable that we have failed to do this in light of the clear evidence that this entire century has been one of revolutionary change, and as the saying goes, we ain't seen nothing yet? I would suggest that one of the primary reasons for our failure to think and act as we should in such revolutionary situation is that we insist on using other words and concepts to describe what's going on. For example, to talk of the development of the oil industry here is merely that, rather than constituting a revolutionary change in the Alaskan way of life. In the broader sense, it's truly one of the wonders of the century that whereas people will resist the forced imposition of a new lifestyle on them in the form, say, of a dictatorial political regime, they will accept without dispute the far more revolutionary transformations brought about by scientific, industrial, technological development, which has been the really subversive revolutionary agent in the nature of human civilization in our time. Well, it's the 1970s. We must change. No one has the right any longer to change our environment and our life without our consent. This must be done through the political process, of course. But industry has a very special responsibility in this regard because simply, and perhaps a little unfairly, it is where the action is. It is no longer good enough to talk in terms of profit orientation or the notion that men are simply creatures of self-interest, etc., or to act on the very Marxian concept that economic considerations are primary. We must begin to think and act in new terms. In truly revolutionary terms, and for that, again, we need time. We also need a natural environment, as unspoiled as it is possible to keep it. We need wilderness, and we need it desperately, too. It is without question our most precious resource. It has always been thus, but again, we have failed to recognize it or to use the right words in discussing it. And I would disagree with Professor Tussing to the extent that it ought to be spoken of in economic terms. The language you use changes the character of what it is that you use, and I would rather retain some mystery in what it is we call wilderness. Remember, please, that if there has been anything truly distinctive about the American, it is his close association with the wild. We must not squander what is left of natural wildness. Remember, too, that we are human beings, that naked ape that one author described, the human animal. And our nature as animals requires the availability of an environment as close as possible to that from which we sprung in our animal form. We need wilderness, all of us, each of us. Federal officers, state governors and their staffs, industry spokesmen, all of us, we need the wilderness. The presence of wilderness helps us immeasurably to cope with the tensions of this quite literally disjointed man-made world, tensions which it is clear are rapidly increasing everywhere. If there be less or no wilderness to go to, or to dream about being able to go to, which is just as important, we can be certain that the tensions will be relieved more destructively than otherwise. The presence of the still great wilderness areas of Alaska, with their potential for helping us all in the fashion I've indicated, is of course the major reason why what is done here is of enormous consequence to all Americans and to people everywhere. The Alaskan wilderness must be protected to the maximum extent possible. An active, constant, adequately staffed surveillance is the key. Not what the statutes say, not what the organizational charts say, not what contract stipulations say, but adequately staffed constant surveillance. Because it is so precious, we must exercise extreme caution before taking any action, such as the construction of the pipeline or anything else, which may reduce or damage it. If we err in this, we must err on the side of caution. If we make a mistake, it must be on the side of calculated slowness rather than unregulated speed. If I seem to be asking too much, then I say again as to the need for new thinking and action. It is, I think, encouraging to be able to add that this perspective has begun to take hold elsewhere, in the field of new drugs and the use of other chemicals, for example, and in the rising concern for the quality of our environment. The message today, it seems to me, is loud and clear. If you're uncertain, don't do it. If you cannot adequately gauge the effectiveness, the consequences, excuse me, hold things up. Go slowly, go very slowly. Now, if there are costs involved in delay, let's pay them. The costs involved in speed, I think, are even greater. And whether in this case, for example, the pipeline, which is only part of what we're talking about. If the pipeline costs $900 million, $1.2 billion, or whatever sum, the people pay for it anyway. The cost of the pipeline being part of the calculation from which the state's royalties are derived. Again, the people pay for it regardless. Finally, if what I've said here is considered merely academic or visionary, rather a strange conclusion to those who also know me as a retired Air Force colonel, command pilot, and all the rest. But if these thoughts of mine are to be considered academic or visionary, then we are really lost. The only approach that can even begin to rescue us from the badly distorted life we call modern civilization is at least the sort of new thinking, careful planning I've only touched on here. I think that it can be done. And it must be done here in Alaska. For Americans, it's truly our last chance. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Professor Konigsberg. The next witness is Sharon M. Cisna of Anchorage, Alaska.
I would like to request the panel permission to read portions of the statement of two people who are on the schedule of the hearing but who were unable to be present. Would that be all right?
The time limits.
Can you keep the whole presentation within 15 minutes?
I will try my very hardest.
All right.
The first statement is the statement by Helen Nienhauser. That's HelenNienhauser. I am in favor of the proposed BLM regulations governing construction of the pipeline. As an Alaskan of 10 years, I do not think lower taxes right now are as important as controlled development. There is no rush to get the oil out except to satisfy the greed of many who stand to profit. The United States will need the oil as much or more several years from now. If the proposed regulations do cause a delay in pipeline construction, I am not going to be upset. A delay is a small price to pay. I do not feel that the federal government should turn control of construction of the pipeline over to the state as has been proposed by some state officials. The state of Alaska is too eager for economic development to be trusted with overseeing this project. The disastrous results of the Hickel Highway prove that the state is not capable of properly supervising construction. While the oil company officials may have good intentions, the men in the field often do not care about pollution, litter, and random destruction of the tundra, and they will pollute, litter, and destroy just as much as they can get away with because it's easier. This must not be permitted, but only with adequate staffing and funding of the regulatory agencies will prevent it. And the second statement I would like to read portions of.
You want to introduce that first statement as an exhibit?
Yes. This is certainly.
It'll be marked then as exhibit number 33.
And the second statement is by Dr. Richard T. Myron. That's Richard T., capital M-Y-R-E-N. I wish this presentation would be made part of the hearings of the Department of Interior for consideration of granting pipeline permits for Arctic oil. The vast Arctic oil fields are in themselves truly a natural wonder, dwarfed only by the strange geological oil formation processes of several hundreds of million years duration and the biological evolutionary process is necessary for oil creation. Likewise, during such periods of oil formation underground, an evolution of land and sea plants and animals produce life complexities, even succeeding in complexities of the oil formations. Such evolution has produced a wondrous web of life forms from tundra plants to the larger and smaller animals, including the fish. It is with this feeling for such wealth underground and the wealth upon its surface that I must now approach the question, can we use both resources without destroying either? Today, it is clear that oil is threatening the existence of the very unique of a very unique place on Earth, the Arctic. Is it right to permit the loss of one at the expense of the other? I fear today the oil industry and the state of Alaska oil leasing and extraction policies will permit the loss of our magnificent treasure, the Arctic wilderness. Clearly, therefore, I must oppose the granting of oil pipeline permits. There are additional considerations which indicate to me that action toward oil policies and permits should be formulated carefully. They relate to what we are doing with oil. For example, I do not find necessarily the rapid extraction of domestic oil to be in the best interests of the country. What better place as an underground storage is there? Shouldn't such strong such storage ensure domestic supplies in the day when our foreign sources are gone or exhausted? As combustion, is combustion the best utilization of oil? What about plastics or food? And with the rise in air pollution, I note some of the older gentlemen are somewhat wheezy. Should we assume that fossil fuels will continue to supply the seemingly growing need for power? Such prospects of a growing need for power are based rather upon an increasing population size and advertisement of more power consumption. If our demographers are right, such continued population growth cannot go unchecked. Then there is the addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere and its increase, which must be checked and is primarily brought about by combustion of fossil fuels. Some believe that our use of fire and the combustion of fuels will reduce the amount of oxygen available for life. The denial to future generations forever of better alternatives through our present actions is perhaps the gravest sin we can commit. And I would like to present this as a...
That'll be marked exhibit number exhibit. 34. Then.
I would like to now present my testimony. My name is Sharon M. Cisna. That's C-I-S-S-N-A. Mr. Secretary and gentlemen of the federal panel, I would like to thank you for this opportunity to speak on this most important topic. I am a citizen of the United States, but far more important to me, I am a resident and a taxpayer of the state of Alaska. The minority groups which I belong to and or may be representational of are a resident of Anchorage, Alaska, a secretary in the petroleum industry, a member of hiking and climbing groups, a member of nature preservation groups. Today I am speaking from my position as a member of a majority group. I belong to the under 30 generation. I belong to a group which will dominate the leadership and decision making in the coming decades, and the group which will live, work, and raise our children in an environment not left by nature, but by man of today and yesterday. What form it will take will be your determination. We have heard many words today by individuals who will not have to live in the mess which they may allow to precede. I only wish I could be optimistic and say the utopia they create. However, that possibility is quickly, if not irrevocably, disappearing from the face of the earth. We have been gathered here by the Bureau of Land Management of the Interior Department to comment regarding the stipulations for the construction of the proposed pipeline. With my familiarity with those stipulations, I find it impossible to comment directly about the very preliminary stipulations, as they are a final step in a determination which I think has not been adequately made. Do we want, one, a pipeline which is constructed without knowledge of the effect of that pipeline on what is a fragile and complete system of plant life, earth form, and wildlife? The stipulations reflect a false feeling that we are ready for construction. Are we? Two, do we want petroleum development on the North Slope without complete state and federal control, without coordination of oil company programs with native training programs, and frequent complete inspection and stipulations regarding the exploration and development of all phases of oil, gas, and mineral production? Or three, do we want development on the North Slope? Do we want the further ruin of the delicate natural wild system? Is the price of development just possibly too dear? I would choose the third at this time. It is for this reason that I will say, not only are the stipulations presented today obviously premature, no matter how fine they may be with their limited planning, but that I wish to request the halting of all exploration, development, and the present companion of those two, destruction, on the north slope of Alaska. We Alaskans must be aware of the dangers of our state being young, unexperienced, and largely unexploited. There has been, to the profit motive, an alluring quality about virgin country. We in Alaska have been wooed by each exploitive industry which has passed through our state, each impressing us that this was the way for Alaska to become independent, each promising riches, each completely justifying its gain and our loss. The few experiences that we have had should have taught us an essential lesson required for the preservation of the very qualities we have chosen to live with, but they obviously haven't. Will we prostitute ourselves to an oil rush as we did the gold rush? Will we not realize the difference between courtship and rape if, as in a courtship, we contract a mutually beneficial and profitable agreement between two consenting and knowledgeable agents? The petroleum industry would be allowed on the North Slope only if they could remove the oil without scar, without damage, without altering the environment. But can they and will they under present conditions? The state of Alaska has not one state park. Its majority of land selections have been potential oil land. The state of Alaska has proven its only interest is in the monetary gain for the state of Alaska, but not for the individual profit or economic and environment gain. The native has been cheapened and cheated by our state government as well as the federal government. His rights to an environment which can support him is certainly primary. However, we would completely wreck that livelihood without realization of our effect. For all the comments presented today promising little damage, I can only determine their sincerity by one, determination of the time and specific studies which have been made of the pipeline and on-site construction. It is obvious that the time has been insufficient. Why was the Livengood Road allowed to proceed? Two, the sincerity not of the state officials or TAPS officials, but the contractors and subcontractors to preserve the environment of the area which they will work in. I find it difficult with the present rush to expect the contractors or the pipes or the TAPS officials to stop coal should a problem arise which will damage or harm the ecology. What would occur if it should be necessary to have more than the predicted 40 miles above ground? This is most likely. Would they halt? They already have proven their disrespect by haste with which they have forced the Bureau of Land Management to consider permits. These facts indicate a compromise between immediate gluttonous benefit and the urgent necessity for man to grab hold of his runaway destruction of the environment. I am not alone in my generation in the cry for the necessity of our heretofore absent control. Perhaps it's a cry of despair because there's really so little we can do, because it's already being done, and although we realize from a lifetime of education that compromise, as if there ever were a just compromise between good and bad, is the best we can hope for. That when firm action must be taken for the very welfare of mankind, private and small power interests will rip their last chance away. Is there such a word as reasonable for the poverty and ravage which rapid, unthinking destruction ensures? Is there a justified compromise to this? Of course not. I repeat, for the obligation of the membership of the Interior Department to ensure a land of opportunity, not devastation, to the generations to follow, a halt must be made. A careful evaluation be taken of values, real long-term values. Wilderness and the purity and wildlife values to the spiritual consumption of men, not only alive today, but those to come, is millions of times more valuable than the predicted oil deposits on the North Slope.
You wish to offer that statement as an exhibit?
I would like to submit this later. Would that be possible?
Within the 15-day period that I specified, that would be fine.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Ms. Cisna. The next witness is Eben Hobson, Executive Director, Arctic Slope Native Association. I suppose we should have the record show that there is no response. The next witness then is Daniel L. Osborne, Alaska Alpine Club.
Thank you for letting me appear today. I come to ask for the scenic protection of all of the Alaska country that the pipeline will traverse, especially for the Murchison Highway area, where it will parallel the road for many miles and will be visible from the car. The Alaska Alpine Club has proposed to the BLM that a scenic corridor be established along the Richardson Highway from Donnelly Dome to Paxson. Since then, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Company has established this Isabel Pass route as an area for their pipeline construction. This area contains scenery extremely typical of Alaska. It contains open tundra, of which you can see man's destruction for miles if he makes it, of which there is none yet. It contains tall spruce forests, completely wild rivers with rapids and calm spots in them. It contains some of the most beautiful, highest, and scenic mountains in Alaska. It also contains glaciers that come right down to the road. This can all be viewed by tourists and Alaskans and many people from their car windshield. I would like to see the fact that the pipeline could not be viewed from the windshield of a car, from the inside. And I have yet to see where any construction of any mass volume, such as the oil, is going to be transported. This has been able to have been hidden from the casual observer's eye. I have seen gravel pits that are supposedly hidden from the driver's eye. They were hidden by 100 feet of trees, which are quite often chopped down before the construction of the new road is complete. This area and many of the areas in Alaska are now unimproved by man. I know it's fruitless for me to ask you not to improve them, to keep the oil in the ground, to keep the smog in the ground, in essence. This will come out. People want it out. People want the smog, people want the oil for their cars, because we are a car-oriented society. But also because we are a car-oriented society, I ask you to keep the visible pollution, the eyesore, away from the roads that people will drive on. Keep the pipeline where it cannot be seen. Screen from the roads. Now, as an individual, I have been observing the state in the state government for quite a while. Recently, I was horrified with the pollution near Fairbanks, right near here, and I went to the State Office of Environmental Services. I found one man there and a secretary. The man informed me he was the only man in the state, and he, or at least north of Glen Allen anyhow, and he was the only man in charge of environmental services. This includes water pollution, air pollution, sewage disposal, and all such things as this. And he said that he had no control of any of the development. He complained of being the only man to patrol everything from the North Slope to Glen Allen, of all of this. And he said he was entirely incapable of controlling this. The state refused to give him the manpower and the money to survey these operations to make sure that the regulations that are now on the state's books are enforced. The regulations now in the state's books are vastly, are terribly weak. They do not provide any strength at all. If you went downtown Fairbanks and just smelled the China, you could realize how ineffective the state government is, even in populated areas where there are many people. This man cannot go downtown in China on a riverbank when he sees a sewage pipe flowing in, open raw sewage flowing in, and just stick a plug in it. He does not have the authority to do this. And the state government of Alaska has asked permission from the federal government to be the sole control over the pipeline building, construction, and protection of the ecology. I say they cannot do it. They have proved they cannot do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Osborne. The next witness is Gerald Ganapole, geologist, Anchorage, Alaska.
Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen of the panel, I would first like to thank you very much for the opportunity to appear at this type of hearing. My name is Gerald Ganapole, G-A-N-O-P-O-L-E, and I am a consulting geologist living in Anchorage. For the past 21 years, I have earned 100% of my income working in and for the oil industry. For the past 10 years, I have lived in Anchorage, and I have had the opportunity to explore many areas of Alaska. And those that I haven't explored, I've fished or camped in. I've been fortunate enough to spend a good deal of my time in the Brooks Range and on the North Slope, and I consider myself an expert in the appreciation and enjoyment of nature. I have traveled throughout some of the world, and especially the rest, and I have found that Alaska has something which much of the world, and especially the rest of the United States, envies and admires, and that is the magnificence, the abundance, and the variety of our natural scene. This is an irreplaceable, valuable commodity, and is therefore priceless. We are now faced with a situation where a gigantic oil field has been found in the midst of one of the most unique and ecologically fragile areas in Alaska, and in the only area of its kind in the United States, the Arctic tundra. As our present civilization and culture requires that this oil field be developed, we are faced with conflicting values, beauty or the beast. Because of lack of proper government regulation, most of the magnificent forests of the Cedars of Lebanon were chopped down to create an arid desert. Because of the lack of government regulation, incredibly vast herds of buffalo roaming hundreds of thousands of square miles were exterminated in a few years. For lack of government regulation, small but significant percentages of Alaska have been irreparably decimated with no return in value to the state. With no government regulations, a pipeline from the North Slope could create an ugly visual scar, wildlife barrier, and physical hazard that would cross and affect 100% of the width of Alaska. terminal shipping facilities at either end could be catastrophes waiting to happen. If it is determined that a pipeline is a virtual necessity, then I can only recommend that it be built in such a way that its present and future impact on the natural scene is negligible. Although I have read the proposed pipeline stipulations, I am unable to determine if their total effect will indeed produce and guarantee an unobtrusive and safe subsurface passageway or a hideous slash across the natural landscape. And I must ask my peers in the many branches of science and in our various governmental regulatory agencies for their very best opinions and efforts in giving me and everyone an ideal natural environment to live in now and for future generations. By this I mean the stipulation should be an enforceable method of achieving an unobtrusive and safe pipeline. If a pipeline cannot be built to this specification at the present time, I would wish the project delayed until it can be, or until other satisfactory methods of oil transmission can be developed. Gentlemen, with science and technology, man has reached the stars. Sociologically, man has yet to take the first step out of the cave. I submit to you that the pipeline you are considering is a social problem as well as a technical problem, and I hope your determinations will reflect both values. Respectfully submitted.
You have a statement that you'd like to put into the record?
Yes, please.
We'll mark the statement exhibit number 35, and Mr. Ganapole.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Ganapole. The next witness is Donald R. Bruce, Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce.
Chairman, panelists, I have a testimony prepared here. I am Donald R. Bruce, president of the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. I have a testimony here representing over 500 businesses in this area. One thing before I start reading the testimony, I have been shocked to hear all the testimony today and how stupid Alaskans are and that we cannot take care of ourselves. All right, testimony prepared for the Department of Interior hearing. The discovery of oil in commercial quantities at Prudhoe Bay in July of 1968 has been the motivating factor in some rather drastic changes in Interior and Arctic Alaska during the 13 months following the announcement of the discovery. Our basic economy has been affected. Our city, borough, and state governmental functions have been affected. Our schools, hospitals, and social services of all kinds have suddenly been strained to capacity. And now, above and beyond these provincial day-to-day problems, we have become the focal point of a nationwide controversy over the conservation of our nation's natural resources. We did not seek these problems, but we welcome the challenge they afford, for they are the problems of growth and are infinitely preferable to the problems of a static or dying community. We are concerned here with only the last of these problems, the conservation and protection of our natural resources and how best we can accommodate the growth and development of industry throughout Interior and Arctic Alaska, while still preserving the natural environment of the area. I do not think there can be any serious disagreement with the concept that such industrial development and sound conservation practices are compatible. What is debatable and controversial are the rules under which we proceed to accomplish the end desired. It is my purpose here today to stress the need for action. Action based upon positive thinking and a common sense approach to the problems involved. We do not object to the conservation and protection of the natural environment of these areas affected by the exploration activities now in progress and the forthcoming construction of a pipeline and transportation system to serve the area. On the contrary, we applaud such efforts. What we do object to is the apparent reluctance of the Department of Interior to expedite action in issuing the necessary permits to allow construction of the pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez and the harassment of the constructing agencies through the inclusion and imposition of unduly restrictive and unnecessary requirements in the guidelines established to govern construction under any permits issued. In this connection, I cannot urge too strongly that in setting up the guidelines under which development of the Arctic regions will be carried out, full use be made of the expertise and knowledge of the many Alaskans who have successfully coped with the problems involved over the past many years. These men have lived and worked in the Arctic. They have built roads and airstrips, established settlements, and spread a network of distant early warning stations from the Bering Sea to the Canadian border. These men are intimately acquainted with the ecology of the Arctic, and their experience and knowledge should be utilized. Full use of the knowledge available, combined with modern technology and equipment, make it possible to accomplish the desired industrial development with minimum disturbance of the area's natural environment. We in Alaska, more particularly we in the northern half of Alaska, live in an Arctic environment, an environment that has often been referred to as hostile and forbidding. From necessity, we have learned to cope with the problems such an environment presents and have adopted our methods and procedures to fit the demanding needs of the area and the climate of the country in which we live. We have a healthy respect for the permafrost that underlies our land and fully appreciate the necessity of preserving the covering tundra, muskeg, and timber. We have built hundreds of miles of roads across this land. We have crisscrossed the valleys with pipelines as large or larger than those being proposed today. And we have built a railroad from Tidewater 440 miles into the interior. We have dotted the area with landing strips for bush plane operation, and all without despoiling the wilderness or permanently damaging what is now emotionally referred to as the delicate ecology of this land in which we live. This we have done, and we can and we will build a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez and thus open the world's greatest known oil reserves for the use and enjoyment of the people of our nation and of the world. We can and we will build an all-weather road from Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay and to the untapped resources of all northern Alaska, including the rich reserves at Bornite and on the Seward Peninsula. We can and we will build an extension of the Alaska Railroad from Fairbanks to these same areas. We can and we will build a system of feeder and auxiliary airfields to serve the demands inherent with the growth and the development of the area. All of this we can do and will do in the best possible spirit of cooperation and conservation. No one could be more concerned with the preservation of the national environment in which we live and work than those of us who have made the great land what it is today. We ask only that you grant us the opportunity to share the knowledge we have gained and that you avail yourselves of the know-how and manpower of the Alaskans who have lived and worked in this Arctic environment since the beginning of the century. Time is of the essence, and the relatively few hundred acres involved in the construction of the pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez have been surveyed, resurveyed, studied, analyzed, and tested time and time again. We respectfully suggest that what is needed at this point in time is positive action on the part of the Department of Interior through an immediate grant of authority for the construction of the pipeline in accordance with the request of Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. A positive approach to the problem and guidelines for growth and development based upon common sense and the knowledge and experience of Alaskans who have proven their abilities will result in a sound and progressive development of Alaska's Arctic regions in the best interest of all concerned.
Do you have a statement?
Yes, we have the copy of the statement here.
We'll mark that as exhibit number 36. I guess that's all then.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Bruce. The next witness is Mike Dalton, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Secretary Train, distinguished panel. My name is Kathleen Mike Dalton. I'm a resident of Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm also a reporter for the Farthest North Daily newspaper.
I see your byline on the front page of the...
Which covers the area...
Today's Daily News Monitor.
You're discussing. We people, if I may, I'll continue with my prepared statement. We people who have made Alaska our home for many years appreciate your real interest and concern, and we thank you and your panel for coming to Fairbanks to hear testimony on this proposed pipeline and service road permits. My personal feelings on this subject do not matter. I came here today to ask you to filter out fact from fantasy. And I'm sure that with your experience dealing with the public, that you're completely capable of doing that. Too much hearsay and unfounded fact has been printed about Alaska. Much truthful and well-researched matter has also been published, however. I want to address myself to that unfounded fact area that has influenced many people in our state and the nation to believe things about our state and its growth potential that simply are not true. I'd like to leave my prepared statement here and make one comment. Recent testimony read by Sharon Cisna of Anchorage from Helen Minhausen, I think it is, demonstrates exactly what I'm talking about. She described the disastrous effect of the Hickel Highway, in other words, the winter road that was constructed. Another person today has referred to this project, which parallels in many respects what is under discussion today, as a hideous slash across the country. In my work with the Farthest North Daily newspaper in the United States, which covers an area bigger than Texas, I might add, I try to deal in facts only. I've lived in Alaska for 20 years, 5 of those years on the North Slope. I've flown over the North Slope many times, too many times to count. I've driven over it where possible. I've ridden snow machines over it. I've walked over it. I even dog sledded over it when I was younger and more agile. And I don't pretend to be an expert in any field, but I have been around a while and I've observed and I have learned a little bit. Back to what I came to talk to you about was fact. This too much opinion, in my opinion, is formed on hearsay, and I want to give you a specific example, and I'll be short, and I'll let other more important people testify. This, I think, was an irresponsible piece of reporting and possibly is the cause of some of the comments like disastrous effect of the Hickel Highway and hideous slash. It concerns this, what I refer to as irresponsible reporting. It concerns the winter road from Lavengood to Sagwan on the slope. A large Alaskan daily newspaper ran a series of stories concerning the impact of oil on Alaska. One of those articles described that winter road as 400 miles of water-filled ditch. Many people reading that article believed what they read. It simply wasn't true. But how many people don't know that wasn't true? The winter road from Livengood to the Yukon River followed an old established trail that some of the men in this very room, and I could point to some of them right now, have used for freighting for many years. The Biddles Airport, by the way, was built by Lytle and Green in the mid-40s. They freighted over that trail. From the Yukon, it followed, in most places, that same trail to Biddles. That trail has been there for freighting for close to 65 years, and it has not been a water-filled ditch. North of Biddles, the winter trail intersected the John River. That's the right name, the John, and followed the John up to the Anaktuvik village. There it hit the headwaters of the Anaktuvik River and subsequently followed the river downstream to a point east of Umiat. From Umiat to Sagwan, it crossed the tundra. That tundra, gentlemen, was frozen and it wasn't excavated. It was bladed from the top, but it wasn't excavated. The John River and the Anaktuvik River naturally are water-filled in the summer months. In the winter, they're frozen ice. They could not have been disturbed by the passage of equipment and truck. Ice disturbs itself when it breaks up in the spring and flows downriver. More than half of that winter trail followed the frozen rivers. It followed another 196 miles of already established trails that had not turned into water-filled ditches, as some riders without proper background and proper research would have the readers believe. Gentlemen, that's all. As I said, I'm not an expert, but I did want to bring this to your attention, and I hope that you will consider it in your final decision. You have some extraordinary expertise in this room, and you've listened to some very valid fact. And Secretary Train, I'd like to thank you particularly for coming, and I hope that you will return and we can have another productive dialogue when everyone in our state of Alaska gets interested in doing something to reestablish over 5 million acres of forest lands that were destroyed this summer. When everyone in Alaska gets excited and wants to do something about restoring the caribou and the moose and the marmots and the muskrat and the mice and their habitats. And again, thank you very much.
Do you have a statement that you'd like to present?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
We'll mark that as exhibit number 37. Thank you. The next witness is Dan Swift, Tanana Yukon Chapter, Alaska Conservation Society.
My name is Daniel W. Swift. I am president of the Tanana Yukon Chapter of the Alaska Conservation Society, which is based here in the Fairbanks area. And I'd first like to comment on some of the side implications of this pipeline. The pipeline route was selected on the basis of minimum cost and also, I might say, minimum environmental disturbance. But along with the pipeline comes a road. And given the present plans for this pipeline, this road will follow a different route than from the Hickel Highway. However, we have been heard talk previously that we should have some sort of a coordinated planning of our transportation. We also hear that of plans, or the develop for the development of plans for a railroad. Now, the railroad probably would not want to be laid out along the route of the pipeline, since the pipeline is projected to go over Dietrich Pass, which is considerably higher than the Anetubik Pass route. One I'm trying to make is that we are pushing ahead to develop this pipeline route. We have another road, this Hickel Highway, and we're talking about a railroad, but we are not really doing any planning about it. This pipeline has not been developed, but this pipeline routing has not been laid out with any of the other longer-term considerations in mind. Railroads and highways also have effects beyond just providing a means of getting from one place to another. They also attract settlement. They attract other land uses, recreational uses, hunting pressure. They also would attract more intense mineral exploration. The point is that we must also consider these factors, that this must also go into our planning. Where, if we're going to have development up there, where should this be? In addition, along the Hickel Highway route, we have talk of the gates, gates to the Arctic National Park. Such a park must have a road access, but should not be bisected by settlement or the scars of commercial development or mining activity. The point I'm trying to make is that the pipeline is not part of a comprehensive transportation network, and it should be, and we'd like to see the planning, either the pipeline delayed or the planning accelerated, so that we have, by the time this permit is granted, a comprehensive plan for the development of this area. And also, of course, taking into consideration the desire of eventually establishing transportation routes over to the Kobuk region, so we don't have unnecessary miles of transportation route. As for the stipulations themselves, they are very comprehensive. I think the Bureau of Land Management has been doing an excellent job of soliciting public opinion, and the other agencies involved, such as the Alaska Water Lab, Geological Survey, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, I think have contributed to a rather fine document in these stipulations.